Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I would call it a happy Monday to all of you, but it is not a happy Monday at all. I just want to dive right into it today because I warned on the show last week that this was coming, that I had heard that Senator Manka Dhingra was going to run for Attorney General of Washington State. And indeed, that is the news that hit us just a couple hours before we started the show today. I'll just read from Manka Dhingra's announcement for you that came up on Twitter. She wrote, "Exciting news to announce today. Challenging injustices and keeping our families and communities safe has always been my North Star." Wow, okay. "And with your support, I'll continue this work as our next Attorney General." So that being her announcement that she's running for Attorney General in 2024. This is the worst thing that could happen to Washington State, would be Manka Dhingra winning in 2024. It is worse to me than Bob Ferguson being the governor of Washington State. In fact, Bob Ferguson was going to be our lead story today. We'll get to it in our second story about this report that came out about his office withholding critical documents in a case. And I put Manka Dhingra first because to me that's worse. And I likened it on Twitter to Shama Sawant being the state's chief law enforcer. It's the same thing. There is no difference. And for people who haven't been watching the show routinely, I want to remind you a little bit about what is so dangerous about Senator Manka Dhingra possibly becoming the Attorney General of Washington State. So Senator Manka Dhingra is a criminal apologist. I mean, she has supported proposals and bills that the only goal of them that I can ascertain is to make life easier on criminals. Now, this past legislative session, Manka Dhingra single-handedly prevented a strong bipartisan fix to our state's broken police pursuit policy from passing. If not for her, a strong bipartisan proposal would have passed this legislative session, but she killed it in her own committee because someone had the brilliant idea of making Manka Dhingra the chair of law and justice in the Senate. And need I remind you what Senator Manka Dhingra had to say about those of us who express concern that police in our communities could not pursue dangerous criminals, which is not a controversial opinion. I mean, we've seen what's happening out on our streets. We've seen the record number of stolen vehicles. We've seen a complete disdain for law and order. But if you remember, when these bipartisan proposals to fix the broken police pursuit policy came out in the House and the Senate, Senator Manka Dhingra said she was not only not going to give it a hearing, but she essentially said that those of us who wanted that bill to pass were just being emotional. Here's what she said.
"I do not have the vehicle pursuit bill scheduled in the Senate, and I'll see what the House feels like sending over to me. I think this policy has become so politicized that people are no longer looking at data or best practices. They're having an emotional reaction to it."
Now, Manka Dhingra, also when it came to police pursuits, she relied on faulty data to suggest that the law that was on the books, which was disastrous, was actually saving lives. In fact, that data was so faulty that a member of her own party called bullshit on it and actually asked an outside expert in law enforcement statistical analysis to come in and review the data that Manka Dhingra was clinging to as her justification for not changing the law, a law that had, again, bipartisan support to fix. And that outside expert came in and said, actually, the data that Manka Dhingra is using is so statistically irrelevant that not only should it not be used for anything, but it certainly shouldn't be used to influence public policy. And even after a member of her own party pointed that out, Senator Manka Dhingra continued to cling to debunked data so she could keep a disastrous public safety policy on the books in Washington State. And now that is the woman who wants to be the chief law enforcer in Washington State. Hell to the no. Hell to the no. Worse than Bob Ferguson being governor. I will put more effort into making sure that Manka Dhingra is not the attorney general. You thought Bob Ferguson was a bad attorney general? You thought that Bob Ferguson politicized things? I don't even want to think about what the attorney general's office would be like if Manka Dhingra wins in 2024. And look, I don't, I have made it a policy not to endorse individual candidates. I don't at this moment plan to move away from that policy, but I will sure as hell issue anti-endorsements where I tell anyone willing to listen not to vote for a particular person. And in this case, I cannot think of anything scarier than Monica Dinkra as the Attorney General of Washington. I don't care what I have to do. And I don't know who's going to rise up to challenge her. I don't know who Republicans have in store. I don't know if there's any other Democrats that actually have a head on their shoulders and care about public safety who are willing to run against her. I sure as heck hope so. And I don't care what I will knock on every single door in Western Washington and tell them why it would be disastrous for our state to vote for Monica Dinkra if I have to. I will spend night and day. Nicole knows I'm super fired up about this. I almost cried when this announcement came out because I genuinely think it would be that bad for our state. And because I was also like, Dory Monson needs to be here for this election. Like, there is not another election in recent memory I can think of that we need Dory here for more than this. And I just could imagine what he'd have to say about Monica Dinkra wanting to be the Attorney General of Washington State. So this is an absolutely horrible, horrible prospect. I couldn't help but just be baffled by her announcement, you know, talking about how challenging injustices and keeping our families and communities safe has always been my North Star. What have you done to keep families and communities safe? You think that just because you served as a prosecutor, that means that you were working to keep families and communities safe? No, I know a lot of activist prosecutors, activist judges, whose job should be to look out for the safety of the community, but who more and more seem to be looking out for the safety and the well-being of criminals. And that, ma'am, is what you have done. And so I will use every fiber of influence that I have in this state, if it's any at all, to make sure that you don't set foot in the Attorney General's office. The only person I can imagine worse for that job than you is Shama Sawant. And who knows, the way things are shaping up for 2024, who knows, maybe Shama Sawant will ask for that job too. Oh, crazy. It's crazy. Okay, moving on to story two, which was going to be our top story today, but the Monica Dinkra thing came up and that just ruined my entire week. So I don't know if you saw this absolute stunner of a story that came out over the weekend, but it's from the Seattle Times. Kudos to the Seattle Times. I mean, something has to be pretty glaringly bad, I think, for the Seattle Times to do a piece that's this disastrous for a Democratic political candidate. So that clues you into it's unavoidable. So here's a story from Jim Bruner, the political reporter over at the Seattle Times. Washington judge fines Attorney General's office, DSHS, in cavalier withholding of lawsuit evidence. In it, Jim Bruner writes, the state attorney general's office and Department of Social and Health Services have been fined $200,000 and face the prospect of forking over hundreds of thousands of dollars more in legal fees for what a judge called egregious and cavalier withholding of evidence in an ongoing lawsuit. King County Superior Court Judge Michael Ryan, in a March 21st ruling, ordered the fine as a severe sanction for the state failing to turn over nearly 11,000 pages of records to attorneys suing over the alleged neglect of a developmentally disabled woman at an adult family home in Kent. And so it's important to understand what's at the center of this case. As Jim Bruner laid out there, you have this woman who's developmentally disabled, and there is an accusation that she was neglected at this family home in Kent. And so they're suing. And so as a part of trial proceedings in the United States of America, we have something called discovery. And discovery is critical to a fair trial because it ensures that both sides are operating based on a full and complete picture of the evidence and of what happened. And so when you have one side that requests pertinent documents, documents that would be pertinent to the case, from, in this case, the Department of Social and Health Services, represented by the Attorney General's office under Bob Ferguson, it is critical, it is expected that those documents be produced in a timely manner. And not only were they not produced in a timely manner, but this judge ruled that in an egregious and cavalier withholding, the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Social and Health Services failed to produce nearly 11,000 pages of records that would be pertinent to this case. And I will say, you might think, well, maybe, you know, maybe it was just documents that they didn't realize would be pertinent and they sort of glossed over. That is not the case. So I want to read some really critical excerpts from this judge's ruling for you, because they paint a pretty troubling picture. So I'll start with this. And again, this court ruling is out there. If you want to read the whole thing, it's not very long, but I've picked out some passages that I think are important to understanding not only what was withheld, but the egregious nature of the Attorney General's office not producing those documents in a timely manner. So the ruling reads, on December 8th, 2022, documents were produced to plaintiff's counsel. The production, so the missing documents, were finally produced. The production included 2,476 records contained in 10,800 pages of documents. And this gets to the heart of the fact that these were clearly relevant to the case. The judge writes, in one of the produced emails, a DSHS employee appeared to be mocking the plaintiff, who is developmentally disabled, and making light of concerns regarding her care. In fact, according to the Seattle Times, the employee had wrote LOL in the email. These documents are also directly relevant to the plaintiff's allegations that DSHS failed to ensure that the plaintiff's needs were being taken care of in an appropriate manner. Thus, not only are these documents relative and responsive to plaintiff's discovery requests, they are also potentially material to the issues that have already been decided on summary judgment and for which extensive discovery has already occurred. So what the judge is saying there is, there is no possible way that the Attorney General's office or DSHS could see some of these 11,000 documents and think, those aren't relevant to the case. Those don't need to be produced as a result of discovery. Again, in this case about neglect of a developmentally disabled woman. And here you've got one of these emails where there's a staff member for the state essentially making fun of this woman's predicament. It's disgusting, and that's one of the documents that is withheld. So I'll go on here, and the judge does not mince words in this ruling. The judge writes, the lack of processes and procedures by the state's largest law firm is very concerning to the court because it evinces a reckless approach to discovery and case management. The court is left to ponder the following. How can an institution as large as the AGO not have proper procedures in place to make sure that all its cases are being properly handled when an attorney is absent for an extended period? And how can there be little to no communication between a paralegal overseeing discovery and the attorney for whom they are working with on the matter? The lack of internal safeguards is deeply troubling to the court and demonstrates that the largest law firm in the Evergreen State, that being the Attorney General's office, does not have adequate procedures in place to ensure that its discovery obligations are met. And again, a law firm, in this case, the AGO's office, run by the same person for the past decade, failing to meet very basic requirements in a court hearing. And that is the requirement of timely and complete discovery. So here you've got Bob Ferguson, who wants to be the governor of the whole state, who cannot even run in a basic way the office he's currently in charge of now, the Attorney General's office. The court's ruling goes on to read, the court finds that DSHS's failure to turn over the documents sooner to its counsel and counsel's failure to exercise reasonable, if any, diligence with respect to these documents is a willful violation of its discovery obligations because there is no reasonable excuse for the 6-month delay. It is undisputed that these documents were responsive to plaintiff's discovery requests, yet no one at DSHS or the AGO's office made any attempt to ensure that its discovery obligations were timely complied with. The court is at a complete loss to understand how a large state agency and the largest law firm in the state could be so cavalier with respect to their discovery obligations and how such a large amount of responsive material could be overlooked and simply ignored for 6 months. Again, we're not talking about 5 pages, 6 pages of questionably relevant documentation. We're talking about 11,000 pages that were clearly relevant to the case and contained evidence of egregious, unconscionable behavior from state employees that the Attorney General's office under Bob Ferguson failed to provide to the plaintiffs. And I'll just read this one last excerpt because it points out something critical is this is not a one-time error from the AGO's office run by Bob Ferguson. This is a pattern of behavior. The judge writes in his ruling, nor is this the first time that the AGO has been called to task for its lack of appropriate procedures. As the plaintiff points out, the AGO and DSHS specifically have been sanctioned for similar discovery conduct in the past. Evidently, despite the judiciary's best efforts, neither the AGO nor DSHS have learned their lesson when it comes to complying with their discovery obligations. Although it occurred in a different context, the AGO's lack of internal controls has been called out by the Court of Appeals. So again, guy wants to be the governor of the state of Washington. And throughout this process, as this judge is calling out the Attorney General's office, just willful disregard for our court system and for fairness in the court system, the AGO's office is trying to blame it on the plaintiffs, as opposed to just coming back and saying, wow, we're sorry, we apologize. Of course, these pages are relevant to the case of this developmentally disabled woman and whether she was neglected and whether she has cause for her claim against the state of Washington. Instead of even, I would have a little iota of respect for Bob Ferguson and the Attorney General's office. If they had come out and said, yeah, this is 100% our bad, we won't blame it on anyone else, we deserve all the criticism. There was like a very placid acknowledgement and disappointment over how things had happened. But again, I mean, when any fraction of your response is to try to push blame onto other people, then you don't belong in a position of leadership. And I think for Bob Ferguson, anything that happens in the Attorney General's office, especially something this egregious, that is going to cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars, that's your fault. And you have to acknowledge that it is your fault. And I do love how, although this is a great story, good reporting by the Seattle Times, and I've read a few other articles about this particular case, I always love how they say it's going to cost the state money. No, it's going to cost us money. Where do you think the state gets its money? This is, in all these lawsuits, I mean, I go back to like the Chaz Chop lawsuits and missing text messages and all that stuff. I go to the lawsuits over the ban on so-called assault weapons. All this stuff costs us money. You know, all these drawn-out court cases that are completely unavoidable, for instance, if we made sure that laws passed in the legislature were actually constitutional before they went into effect, it's like they do not care how many millions of dollars they spend defending the state, defending state agencies, defending state lawmakers for completely reprehensible behavior or skirting around the laws. It's because they don't treat our money like real money. They just treat it like some bottomless pit of money that we're going to continue to give to them because we do, and because there's a big segment of our electorate that continues to vote to give them more money. It's just egregious. So not a great start to Bob Ferguson's, well, it's a good thing it's just an exploratory campaign, right? It's a good thing he's just exploring and it's not a real campaign because really not, if it were a real campaign, that would be a really bad start to a real campaign for governor. Sellwithwest.com. Sellwithwest.com is one of our wonderful sponsors. If you're in the market to sell your home, check out sellwithwest.com. There's a couple things that you can do while you're there. There's a handy little calculator tool that you can go to figure out what the value of your home is right now. It might be better than you think it is. And you can do that there. And you can also learn more about their innovative marketing strategy and how they work to get the most possible eyeballs on your home to get you the best possible price with the fewest contingencies. Wes Jones has been doing this for a long time. And he's just an all-around great guy. He's been great for us to work with. And so I know you'll just really enjoy having him by your side during the home selling process. And he also told us that he does see a window of opportunity right now in the market. And you've probably seen it in your neighborhood. There are a few more homes coming online for sale after a period where it was pretty, pretty slow out there. So he thinks that there's enough activity right now, but not too much where you will still have people competing for your home, especially if it's in certain price points.
Today, it's a pretty solid time. If you are listed on the market, you are likely to be one of the only homes for sale in your neighborhood. And that is a fantastic position to be in. Where are we at in 3 or 4 months? Well, if interest rates go up, buyers have less purchasing power and homes will probably take longer, which means that you will likely be competing against more of your neighbors.
Check out sellwithwest.com. Again, that's sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. Okay, let's get to the state of downtown Seattle, which, hint, not great. But now we have some data to sort of show us in numbers what we all already knew. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure to sign up for their newsletter. All right, there was this Axios article out talking about how there are a lot of downtowns across America that are struggling to make a comeback. And they link it really to pre-pandemic levels, but there's of course a lot more going on at the same time. So the article from Axios, which American downtowns are thriving and which are struggling? Now, I'm sure it will come as no surprise that Seattle is near the bottom of the list in terms of downtowns that are making a comeback. Seattle ranks 51st on the list. So in terms of downtowns that are doing well, like who we should be looking to, and this graph is from Axios, Salt Lake City, Utah, doing great. They are booming after the pandemic, back at them. Bakersfield, California. Let's see, there's a couple other. Baltimore, which is great. Baltimore is doing better. San Diego, California, Honolulu, Tampa, Florida. And then you get into the ones that are really struggling at the bottom of the list, very bottom, number 63. San Francisco, again, not a surprise to anybody. Portland, Oregon, 61, not a surprise. And then Seattle is at 51. Now, I will say, and we've seen from our friend Jonathan Cho in the last few weeks, that despite efforts to really revitalize downtown Seattle, you know, he's posted some videos showing the drug dens are still very much alive in downtown Seattle. And so we know that we still have some issues, despite, I think, some honest efforts from the current mayor, Bruce Harrell, to revitalize the area. But one of the positive things, I think, one of the reasons maybe Seattle isn't closer to the bottom of the list is Amazon has asked its workers to come back to downtown Seattle a little more often, which we've been talking about and I think is truly one of the things that is going to be important for downtown Seattle is to get people who aren't there to use drugs or steal things or commit crimes back to downtown Seattle. So obviously you have thousands and thousands of Amazon workers and them being back downtown to work a few days a week, to go to the restaurants, to go shopping and the dry cleaners and the doggy daycares, to go down to Pike Place Market. Having that activity to activate downtown is so critically important. And that's why I said that is a gift from Amazon. It is an absolute gift from Amazon to bring workers back to downtown Seattle. Now, I don't know what Amazon's motivations are, if that was them being generous and saying, hey, let's help save downtown, or I've heard people say that it's because instead of doing forced layoffs, they'll just have people who don't want to come back to the office, so they just quit on their own. And I don't know what it is. Either way, it's a freaking gift. And I saw some tweets from folks who were saying, wow, Westlake Park looks better. There's actually people there hanging out, etc. So great. So you would think, okay, everyone should be excited about Amazon having workers back downtown because Seattle's near the bottom of the list for downtowns and their post-pandemic recovery. And so, of course, everyone is thrilled with having Amazon workers. Well, apparently that's not the case. So Julia Reed, who is a Washington State representative, a Democrat, I want to read for you the tweet that this woman sent out around the time Amazon workers started to come back. My goodness, she writes, it seems most of the Amazon back to work folks are choosing car commutes, anti-climate pledge, sound transit chaos, and almost forgot about block the box, which is where you pull out and you block like the little pedestrian walkways because you're trying to take a turn and maybe you couldn't do it. She writes, if Seattle PD was out ticketing, Mayor of Seattle would have made a fortune on this commute alone. So just ponder this for a second. So here you have, and Julia Reed, I think she represents like the, it's now called Uptown, like it used to be called Lower Queen Anne area of Seattle in the state legislature. Here she is, my goodness, complaining about the way in which these Amazon employees are choosing to come back to the office. How dare they choose car commutes? That's not climate pledge friendly. Representative Reed, I can't even believe someone has to say this to you, but for the sake of the city you represent, maybe keep your petty grievances about Amazon employees blocking walkways on their first couple days back to the office, maybe keep those to yourself. Because we need every single person from Amazon who's willing to come back to the city to come back to the city. So maybe keep your first world problems about the car commute to yourself. But this, again, is just representative of the fact that all about them and their needs. And I looked at this when, you know, way back five or so years ago, when Seattle City Council was vilifying Amazon, trying to push a tax on high-paying jobs, a head tax on Amazon, with no care or concern for what their vilification of Amazon would do to the city that they were supposed to be representing. And now when Amazon, despite all the reasons not to bring back people back to the office, like some of their employees being shot, one of their employees being beat in the back of the head with a baseball bat at random, despite all the reasons Amazon could say, no, you know, we're not going to bring our employees back to Seattle. In fact, if we're going to have them come back, we'll have them come back to Bellevue. Despite all of that, they're still faced with Democratic representatives like Julia Reed, who, instead of seeing the value of having Amazon workers come back to downtown Seattle, whether it's in a plane, a train, or an automobile, she wants to complain about how much traffic has returned to her neighborhood and about whether that's climate friendly. Representative Reed, get a grip. Get a grip. And for once, think about what is best for the economic vitality of your city. All right, that segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. I was talking on the show last week about how Governor Jay Inslee is on a tour to rewrite history. Truly. He is out there in Pasco signing pro-law enforcement bills with cops standing behind him like, we love our men and women in uniform and we need more police officers, after he didn't say jack during the police defunding ordeal, claimed he didn't know about Chaz Chop, didn't speak up at all when it would have made a substantial difference. And so this segment of Unbelievable is going to be very, very short. But I feel the need, because I almost gagged when I saw this, to point out the governor's continued rewriting of history when it comes to what he has done and what his policies and what he said and not said have done to those who protect and serve our communities. So the governor over the weekend sent out two tweets, one talking about firefighters and one talking about law enforcement. So let me read these two tweets to you and you tell me if you had the same reaction that I had. So in one of them, this weekend, May 6th to 7th, we take a moment to remember the 144 fallen firefighters from 2022 and previous years. Let us not forget their heroism and keep their families in our thoughts as we lower the flag in their honor. And then in a tweet sent out just a couple hours before that, he said, law enforcement officers risk their lives every day to keep communities safe. Today, we added the names of 7 fallen officers to the Washington State Law Enforcement Memorial and awarded 18 officers with the state's Medal of Honor for their bravery. I'll give you one guess what bothers me about this. Anybody? Anybody? I'm sure people are guessing correctly. You value their bravery and what they do and what they sacrifice for our communities. But when they didn't want to get a vaccine that had only been out for a short period of time, none of that bravery mattered. None of that willingness to serve and sacrifice for their communities mattered because you fired them. Because you fired them. You fired dedicated members of the Washington State Patrol. And did you fire firefighters directly? Not in every instance. You had agencies that were able to get creative, some agencies who weren't willing to get creative and indeed did fire unvaccinated firefighters. You had people who went out every single day in the middle of a pandemic, you know, going to Life Care Center at Kirkland, into the belly of the beast of the COVID outbreak, not knowing what it would mean for them and their families, risked their lives. But when they weren't willing to get the COVID vaccine, you fired them. And you vilified them and you demonized them. And so forgive me, Governor Inslee, if I really don't want to hear you thank members of law enforcement, thank firefighters for their service and their sacrifice and their bravery, because you have shown that your appreciation for those aspects of people who protect and serve our communities, that it has exceptions. And even when the federal government, the Biden administration, has decided they're going to move away from mandating the COVID vaccine, at every single turn, when it has been presented to you that mandating the vaccine no longer makes sense, you have stood firm to a policy that is beyond comprehension. And as a result, in this state, you have heroes who serve their communities for years on end, who demonstrated bravery and sacrifice that you now claim to value. You have people who have never been able to return to a job in uniform, in part because of the policy that you are helplessly clinging to. And so honestly, shame on you. Absolutely unbelievable. Mike and I took the First Mark Challenge. And what's interesting about the First Mark Challenge is, well, it's not interesting, it's cool. It's free. It costs you nothing to do the First Mark Challenge, have First Mark Insurance go over your existing insurance policies, your existing needs for what you need to cover, and then to give you their recommendations about what companies and what policies might benefit you, and maybe even ones you have that you don't need. And so you go through this whole First Mark Challenge, which Mike and I did. It consisted of three meetings, you know, the initial Zoom meeting where they went over our current policies and our needs, and then they came back and they kind of gave us a side-to-side comparison of here's what you have, here's what we think you need. Mike and I found out we were woefully undercovered. And again, we never pay First Mark for anything. We're now a member of the First Mark family. First Mark doesn't charge us for the service of doing all of this work to go through our current insurance coverage and what we need. They get paid by companies that we end up working with. And so anyway, the First Mark Challenge was awesome for Mike and I. You know, we work so hard for what we have, and to think that we were as underinsured as we were is terrifying, but it's all fixed now. As of the first of the month, we are properly insured and where we need to be. So check out First Mark, do the First Mark Challenge by going to firstmarkinsurance.com. Again, that's firstmarkinsurance.com. And make sure that you tell them that you heard about them on the Undivided podcast and get all your family members to do the First Mark Challenge as well. I know one of the things Dave Taylor and I talked about is how you have a lot of folks who are either recent retirees or building up to retirement. You've worked hard your entire life. You've built this kind of nest egg to be able to retire on. And it is terrifying the number of people who they encounter who do not have proper protections. And you could lose everything you've worked for. So I was like, oh my God, I need to have my mom take the First Mark Challenge. Okay, we were going to get to the border crisis today, but I think we'll skip it since our video is not working. And we're going to work on doing some in-depth coverage of that this week. Because as you guys know, Title 42 is coming to an end. And the situation at the southern border, if it weren't already at a breaking point, it is absolutely at a breaking point now. You know, you have this, and I've seen some of the videos. I saw this great video from Bill Malusian at Fox of their drone just showing this massive, never-ending line of migrants waiting to get into the United States. So essentially what the end of Title 42 means, it was a pandemic-era mandate that made sure gave Border Patrol a more quicker avenue to turn people away because of the pandemic and the health risk of having people just pouring into the country. So when that's gone, what do you have left? And so, I mean, it's going to be so bad. The Biden administration is sending National Guard troops to the southern border. So we know it's going to be a disaster. And I think the real question is, how tough is the Biden administration willing to get to try to, first of all, vocally, telling people do not come to the southern border, and also really differentiating between those who have legitimate asylum claims and those who do not. You know, we have an asylum process, but I promise you the tens of thousands of people coming up to the border, it feels like every week, not all of them have legitimate asylum claims. And you have to put your foot down as a country and really be able to distinguish, but they're just overrun. I mean, even if they had the political will at this point, how do you even begin to process that many people coming to the southern border? You absolutely can't. So it's a disaster. So throughout the week, we're going to have some reports, hopefully from the southern border. I have a few friends who are reporting from down there and to talk about what's going on. Okay, let's take questions from those of you who are watching or listening to the show live. Okay. Oceana. Oh, is that a real name? Is that a last name? Writes, I like to think that we won't elect crazy, but Seattle folks will vote for almost any candidate that just says equity. That's true. I mean, that's why I'm so freaked out about Monica Dingra, is I can see a universe where she's elected. if there's no other D's next to her name and it's like Monica Dingra and a Republican, then I just, Republicans have a hard time winning statewide office. I mean, I think it's nearly impossible. And so people will just vote for, and how many Washingtonians, how many voters truly are familiar with the ins and outs of the police pursuit debacle and what Monica Dingra did and her past votes on things? I mean, we're all political nerds, but how do you get that message across to people who aren't about how dangerous it would be? I mean, I think the best comparison, because everybody knows Shama Sawant, is just to say she's basically Shama Sawant 2.0. Their take on political and public safety issues, I think that Monica Dingra has been less outwardly aggressive toward law enforcement, but I think the things that she supports amount to the same sort of view of men and women who serve. All right, Deanne wrote, I'm willing to deal with technical difficulties to hear the truth for a change. Thanks, Deanne. Real struggle for a Monday. I'm definitely more conservative than you, Brandy, but I appreciate your work. Yeah, I imagine. Well, I appreciate your recognition of that. You know, I was at an event the other day where someone was trying to almost like challenge my conservatism. Like, you're not a Republican. I'm like, you're right. I'm not. So this debate's not going to go anywhere because you're trying to like list all the reasons why I'm not a Republican and I'm not going to disagree with any of them. So that's just funny. Donna on Patreon says hard pass regarding Dingra. Yeah, I'm telling you guys, we're going to have to do a boots on the ground, door to door campaign. We got to figure out who's going to run against her. Nicole, would you join me for a door to door campaign?
Possibly.
Is your mic on?
Yeah, my mic's on. It sounds weird in my head, but we'll see okay. How that's working too.
Possibly. You wouldn't join me door to door to make sure Monica Dingra's not elected?
Walking door to door doesn't sound really fun.
You get your steps in and you save the state.
Yeah, that's, I would get my steps in.
I didn't expect this level of apathy from
you. I'll stay back on the sidewalk and let you go door. I'll hold your water.
Wow. I thought you cared about the state, and now I'm learning that you don't.
Do you have some favorites that you want to run against her?
You know, yes.
Not
I mean,
ready to say.
I think Federal Way Mayor Jim Farrell would be a good choice. I mean, he should have been the King County prosecutor, but hey, if he had to lose that election to win this one, I think that'd be a good choice.
Maybe that would explain his endorsement.
Bob Ferguson?
Yeah.
Maybe he's hoping. Well, I don't know if he's considering running for AG.
I know.
But there's got to be some reason to explain his endorsement besides the personal friendship of Bob Ferguson. I think Jim would be great. And again, like, I'm sure there are people who'd be like, no, we have to back a Republican. You can do that, but you'll hand the election over to Monica Dingra. Mm-hmm. Unless some Republican comes out of the woodwork I'm not familiar with who would be great and has cross-party appeal.
Right.
But there's just none coming to mind.
Okay.
I think this election is going to be about choosing your battles. And look, the Republican Party is essentially a corporation. And they're always going to want to make sure or try as hard as they can for a member of their party to be elected. And that's understandable. That makes sense. They're never going to back down and be like, well, if we do this, then a worse Democrat will be elected. That's just not how the party system works. And so, I mean, they're not going to have that internal conversation about how, well, maybe we shouldn't run someone because if we do, then Monica Dingra will win. That'd be terrible for the state. They're not going to be willing to do that. So anyway.
Okay. I'll go door to door with you.
No, now you're not. You're disinvited now. You're disinvited. I'll bring someone from the live chat. I'll bring subscribers with me and we'll go door to door because obviously you don't care enough. And Nicole has just endorsed Monica Dingra for Attorney General. I take that as a placid endorsement of Monica Dingra. You should be ashamed of yourself. Okay. Let's see. Matthew says, in light of the Seattle Times article on Bob Ferguson, will anyone from the Times actually question Ferguson at a campaign press or watch the Times endorse him for governor? That's a good point.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we'll see who runs against him. But if it's any Republican, I imagine the Times will just endorse Bob Ferguson.
Absolutely.
Although the Seattle Times editorial board is way more reasonable than like the Times newsroom. But hey, Jim Bruner did a hell of a story on this. And that's why I say, like, if things are egregious enough, you know, even the Seattle media outlets will go after Democratic candidates because that's quite the story to drop a week into someone's exploratory campaign for governor. Julie writes, did Ferguson know this was coming and that's why he only announced as exploratory? Did he want to wait and see how it turned out before announcing? I don't think so. I mean, I think the exploratory thing was all about trying to appear humble, as if like people don't consider him the heir apparent for the job. He had to have known that this was all going on behind the scenes, because this case has been brewing for some time. He would have known about the discovery issues and that eventually there would be a ruling on it. So I just don't, honestly, I don't think he cares. And I think he believes that he's going to get elected no matter what kind of baggage comes out.
And it will be an example of how some of the media chooses what to cover and what not to cover, because I haven't seen it anywhere else yet.
Well, I saw it in the Tacoma News Tribune.
Okay, but
I think McClatchy did something and the TV AP News. Did something. Yeah, so if you see it on the TV News website, it's probably an Associated Press article, because mm-hmm. the AP did a story that aired, that was published in the Tacoma News Tribune. And if you don't know how AP works, it's basically a news service. So that's why sometimes you see the exact same headline on like every station. It's because they have AP stories that populate.
Right,
but yeah, you haven't seen it on any TV news?
I haven't.
I'm sure it's been on.
It could be there.
Okay, I'll look. I don't want to accuse them of
not. I don't want to accuse them
yet, because I haven't watched all the newscasts.
That's what I said. We'll see how it picks up this week, because it is a big story. But it did get thrown in over the weekend, and they didn't put it on Monday and let it catch fire over the week. But it will get swept under the rug, and he won't get much backlash.
Yeah. Danny said, Ferguson can't even run a two-car funeral. I wonder where you got that line from.
Where.
That's funny. Becky said, our state reps need to introduce a bill to invoke personal financial accountability for all of these mess ups. I think you're referring to all the lawsuits that like we pay for with the state pays for that we pay for, right? Yeah, I agree. I think there should be. Well, that's kind of tough, because it's like you can have things that happen in good faith that are still someone's fault, and there's still going to be a judgment or a ruling. But then I think it's much different to have something that's egregious or intentional, like the Chaz Chop disappearance of text messages. When it was just one person's text missing, I'm like, I could see how that happened. But when it's like everybody who made any decision of consequence during Chop, it's like, okay, you cannot convince me that that wasn't intentional. So maybe there's something to that. Let's see. Kelly said, I saw you at the Gary Allen concert. Yeah, Nicole and I went to the Gary Allen concert on Friday?
Friday night, yes.
What did you think of it?
Oh, I love Gary. He's my guy, so.
I
loved it.
I love country music, and mm-hmm. I knew who he was, but I didn't think I knew a lot of his songs, but it turns out I did.
Yeah.
There were quite a few songs that I was familiar with. I will tell you, though.
90s.
Wow, there was some real wild women around us.
There were.
Oh my gosh. There was a lot of making out.
Lots of
making out, where I'm like, there was just this woman. I mean, she was dancing her life away. I was like, good for you.
Yes.
She was kind of hair whipping everyone around her.
Hair whipping.
It was funny because there was this, and I'm sure they're very nice, and if they're watching, mm-hmm. we love you. Thank you for watching. There was this woman next to Nicole who kept fiddling with her hair. And, you know, the seats are pretty close. And every time she'd like hit Nicole with her elbow, it was every 60 seconds.
Yes. Maybe she had some new extensions. Maybe she had some new style going on. Anyway, flip in front of my face every, 60 seconds at least.
It was quite entertaining. But I thought he was good. I mean, it was interesting. He came out and he didn't have like a cowboy hat on or anything. And he kind of looked like a washed up 90s pop star. And then he changed halfway through into like this leather coat thing and a cowboy hat. I was like, that looks like a country music star.
He switches characters there somewhere in the middle.
I saw a lot of undivided fans at the Gary Allen concert.
Show Air Center?
Yeah.
It's our people.
Kent, you are our people. It was really nice to meet a lot of you. Some people are always like, oh, I don't want to bother you. I'm like, you're not bothering me. I'm here drinking. Like, bother away. I love it. Okay, thank you for the comments, per the usual. All right, let's get to our closing sanity check for the day. Over the weekend, I was part of a panel at the Mainstream Republicans of Washington conference over in Leavenworth, and it was me, Jonathan Cho, and then Mario Lotmore is his name. He runs the Linwood Times. And the conversation was bringing balance back to the news media and how you have some of these independent outlets popping up to try to, not give Republicans like an upper leg up. upper leg, a leg up, but to make sure that they're actually treated fairly. You know, I feel like in Seattle, there's so much focus on, I hate Republicans, Republicans bad, when they have no power in Washington state. And so I think that's really silly. But it got me thinking about this thread that I saw on Twitter that I just had to share with you guys. So it was actually, this is something that was brought up in 2020 by an independent blog called Tablet Mag, but it was shared again by an independent journalist on Twitter. And to me, it explains so much of the divisiveness happening in media and in politics and on social media. And it has to do like with race and how the media covers race and how that has changed substantially over the years. So what I want to show to those of you who are watching the show today, and I'll explain for those of you who are just listening, what I want to show is the a few graphics that, oh my God, absolutely speak volumes for what's going on. So this first one explains and it shows visually how often the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post used the word racist or racism in coverage over the years. And what the, again, tabletmag.com found is that use of the words racist, racists, and racism increased by over 700% for the New York Times and 1,000% by the Washington Post between 2011 and 2019. Think about that for a moment. Do you think that racism has increased by 700% or 1,000%? Between 2011 and 2019? Of course not. But the usage of those phrases in some of the largest newspapers in the country, in the world, increased exponentially. I'll go back to the next slide. So this one has to do with use of the words white privilege. Hold on a second. I'm trying to bring this up on my own. Give me one second. Well, we're having technical issues. Okay. White privilege, whiteness, racial hierarchy, which, what does that mean? And white supremacy. So again, a very, very similar pattern where you have in some instances a 1,500% increase in the use of those words between 2013 and 2019. Again, do you think that there's been, you know, a 1,500% increase in instances of white privilege? No, it's that the media like invented that word, or some activist somewhere invented the word white privilege, and then they just shoved it down our throats like never before. Okay, we'll keep moving on in these graphics because it's all coming to a point about what this sort of reporting and the media does to the rest of us. So they did another graphic that had to do with the words systemic or structural racism and racial inequality or racial disparity. And again, you see like a 1,000% increase between 2013 and 2019 in entities like the New York Times and the Washington Post for those types of words. So then, again, Tablet Mag looks at how did that influence people's perception of racism and racial issues. So let me show you this next chart. So this looks at, there was a question, just the general question, do you know anyone who you would consider a racist or not? And so it looks at it from, so the blue is 2006. Polls that asked that question in 2006. And then green is 2015, okay? So what you'll notice is that across most demographics, so for Black Democrats, Hispanic Democrats, and white Republicans, it either stayed the same or for white Republicans increased just a tad when asked, do you know anyone who you would consider a racist or not? For white Democrats, that jumped from 45% saying, yes, I do, in 2006, to 64% in 2015 saying, yes, I know someone who I would consider a racist. So I would ask you, have they just expanded for white Democrats based on media coverage, their definition of what they consider a racist to be? That seems like the likely scenario, that they were fed so much by these major media institutions about race and racism and white supremacy, that you had white Democrats who expanded their definition of racism, so much so that a majority of white Democrats would say, I know someone who I believe is racist. Okay, one more slide I want to get to, and I think this one is the most telling of all of them. The question is, how big of a problem is racism in the U.S. today? Is it a big problem? Somewhat of a problem, a small problem, or not a problem at all? You'll say, see, around 2010, you had people who were really thinking, yeah, like we're doing okay in the United States of America. I don't consider it a huge problem. So in 2011, just 35% of white liberals thought racism was a big problem in the United States. In 2015, that number was up to 61%. And in 2017, that went up to 77%. In 2017, 77% of white liberals considered racism in the US a big problem, compared to just 35% in 2011. Now, are we really to believe that racism got that much worse in the US from 2011 to 2017? Of course not. But what you're seeing reflected there is a reflection of the increase in talk of racism, white supremacy, institutional racism, et cetera, that was used in the largest, the most circulated newspapers in the country. And I think what that shows you, and it's our sanity check for a reason today, because I think some of us might be like questioning our own sanity when we look at all the media outlets and the conversations that try to convince us that we're a racist country, and that our neighbors are racist, and that Republicans are racist. The media did that to us. The media makes us feel that way. The media makes people question whether they're racist, whether they're white supremacists, whether they have white privilege. And it's because in some cases, 1,500% more references to issues of racism and white privilege and white supremacy over a span of like 10 years in this country. The media is responsible for so many of the divisions that are happening in our country, and for making us feel like we have to dislike one another, for making us think so little of our friends and our family and our neighbors, for making people expand their definitions of who's a racist. The word racist is one of the worst things that you can be called. But more and more often, I would ask you to consider whether that word and the meaning of that word has been diluted by these narratives that were being fed by the media. And I believe that the answer is yes. And that has been your sanity check for today. And that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Sorry for the technical issues today. That's all right. We still did a show. We'll have to revisit some of those sound bites tomorrow, yeah, maybe.
The show must go on, and it did.
The show must go on, and I had a bad hair day. On top of all of that.
Oh, no.
On top of everything, I had a bad hair day. All right, but I did work out today. You know what? That's the one positive. I actually went to a gym this morning.
You did.
I'm trying to tone. Oh, we didn't get fit in our Eastside Weight Loss Clinic ad.
Do it.
Oh my gosh, let me do that before the show ends, considering I was just talking about going to the gym. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. I have lost 35 pounds, probably 36 after my gym visit this morning. I was in there just sweating up a storm. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. I'm down 35 pounds since I started the program in November. We got this awesome email from an undivided viewer who's lost a bunch of weight, and they sent a before and after picture and this really nice write-up about how it's changed their life. Maybe I'll read that on the show tomorrow. So if you, like me, maybe put on a few pounds or 42 pounds during the pandemic, visit EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. And just schedule a free 15-minute virtual online or by the phone consultation. It's really easy. You just go to the website, click on schedule a consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan, and they can tell you about the program, tell you whether it's right for you. And look, you could be in just tip-top shape by the summer. Man, I lost most of my 35 pounds in just 2 months. So summer's approaching, so visit EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, that's been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. And look, we're going to need to do some door-to-door on Monka Dhingra and Bob Ferguson while we're at it. So I'm going to hold on to that commitment to give Common Sense a comeback, because I might be begging you to come door-to-door with me and your community. Anyway, if you have not become a subscriber to the show, sign up at undividedpod.com. It's a one-stop shop for all things Undivided. You can figure out how to watch the show, listen to the show, or become a supporter of the show for just $5 a month on Patreon or Locals. So go to undividedpod.com. In the meantime, Nicole and I are going to figure out what the hell happened with our audio today, and we will be back here for another live show at noon tomorrow.